Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. Namo tassa bhagavato arahato sammasambuddhassa. That is the oldest way of saluting, paying homage to the awakened state, and it's a Pali language, and it was the salutation that was used by Shakyamuni Buddha. Namo means naming, tassa is the state of, bhagavato means blessed, the blessed state of. Arahato has five meanings. One of them is breaking the spokes, that is to say, the round of what in the Buddhist teaching is called dependent origination, and it is found in all the schools of Buddhist teaching, the 12 steps on the wheel of life in the Tibetan tradition. You know, the Tibetan wheel of life with the great god Yama with his fangs sunk into the top and his claws, top and bottom, holding it, is usually his little, nice little tiger's tail curling out the bottom. Around the rim of it, you see 12 different pictures. They represent the 12 steps of dependent origination. In the center of it, you see the six realms, human, no, demigod, human, and God are on the top. Animal, hungry ghost, and hell are on the bottom. Excuse me. I think my voice must be changing. I'm finally growing up. So to decide what sex I am. Oh yeah, that's settled. Pardon? Maybe? Oh no. Well, maybe, you're right, maybe. And in the center, you have three animals, a pig, a snake, and a rooster. And they represent greed, hatred, and delusion, which are the three states of consciousness that continuously, they're each holding the tail of the one in front, and they continuously cause the wheel of rebirth to turn. Continuously. So this is, in the usual Buddhist tradition, this is a very wonderful family portrait of how the continuum consciousness is not changed by such events as birth and death. You understand? This is like the dependent origination is like a snapshot of any moment of consciousness. In looking at the states that are continuing the round, that samsara means blind wandering. The paticca samuppada is like freezing for a moment the continuum consciousness, and like a good scientist taking a minuscule slice of it and putting it under a microscope. Okay? The continuum consciousness is not frozen. But in order to understand what causes the ongoing drive, this was the great understanding that Shakyamuni Buddha perfected after he perceived reality, perceived things as they are. And this is one of the major teachings in all Buddhist tradition. If you have on the one hand the 12 steps of dependent origination, then on the other hand you have the Heart Sutra. And they are both different ways of looking at the same truth. You could say dependent origination is the mind that names, the left brain looking. You could say that the Heart Sutra is the mind that feels, the experiential mind. And looking at the same phenomena, former is not separate from emptiness, emptiness is not separate from form. Because the dependent origination goes dependent on ignorance, the state of wandering arises depending on, and so forth. It goes through the 12 states, right? And then it goes through the reversal of those 12. With the cessation of ignorance, there's a cessation of this. With the cessation of this, there's a cessation of this, and so forth. Through the 12 steps backwards. So it is both the turning in the ongoing endlessness of greed, hatred, and delusion, creating the next stage of becoming, the next stage of becoming. And if you reverse that, then with the cessation of greed, hatred, and delusion, having such powerful effect on consciousness, then the whole wheel ceases to function. It's like a whole gel is taken out of the view, and consciousness is not perceiving through that limited grid. Is that clear? So the Heart Sutra approaches the same thing. Form is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness is not separate from form. Feeling is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness is not separate from feeling. Perception is not separate from emptiness. Emptiness is not separate from perception. It's looking at each of the five aggregates. Do you know, understand what I mean when I say five aggregates? Any of you not understand? Okay. I'm going to do a bit of basic Buddhism today just to give you an idea of why you practice the four foundations of mindfulness. You can just practice and it will be as efficacious, but you might not necessarily know why. So your skill in passing that on to others will be severely restricted, because we tend to pass on what we already know. So someone else might have a different way of understanding than you, so you won't see where they're slotting in to the wheel. You won't necessarily understand how the best way to describe to them what it is you have gained as a way to, for the downgoing of suffering. So I really am very much a practitioner who believed the Buddha when he said two paths are necessary, study and practice. So you're going to get some theory, and I'll try to throw in enough bad jokes to keep the oxygen flowing. Okay? Is this a deal? Feel free to move around and squirm. And those of you who were at the workshop yesterday, when we did the five dakinis, the five energies, you know, each one of them was a different quality, right? They we defined them basically in terms of color and of element. They can also be defined in terms of the five aggregates. And often are. In the Sutta Pitaka, which is the hearing teaching, the teaching that the Buddha walked around northern India and Nepal for 45 years, just talking to people everywhere, working with whoever was present, and not particularly meditators. For example, the woman who had gone mad because her only child had died, and she was carrying this corpse around asking everyone for medicine. And so people began to avoid her. Hot country, India, and corpses don't maintain their pristine beauty at the moment of death for that long. So, and also she was a bit insistent that if she could just get the right medicine, everything would be okay. So one person had just been to hear the Buddha teaching. He was outside of the town that she had wandered to. And she came to this person and said, "I need medicine. Do you know, have you got medicine? My child is sick. I just need some medicine quickly." And he said, "Oh, there's a doctor just down the road," and sent her to see the Buddha. And she came to the Buddha, and she has this child, and she said, "I need medicine." He says, "Oh, right, you do. It's true." He doesn't say, "Oh, don't be foolish, woman. Your child's dead. He sees what is possible for that being to hear. He says, oh, you're right, woman, that's right. You know, leave the kid here and go to town, and I want you to get these things, these ingredients, and I'll make the medicine. You get this and this and this and this, and you get, oh, yeah, get mustard seed. And she's on her way. She's so grateful. She's really anxious to get to town. He says, oh, by the way, the only thing you have to make sure of is the mustard seed has to come from a house where no one has died. Oh, right, she says. Excellent move. So off she goes. And after she knocks on enough doors and is beginning to say, oh, someone has died here. Oh, someone has died here. Oh, and someone else bursts into tears and talks about the death. And someone else is like, oh, yeah, finally the old bugger died. You know, all these different reactions. But what she is beginning to perceive is just because it hasn't arisen in her life with something she loved before, it doesn't mean it isn't true. Doesn't mean it isn't true. So she suddenly understands that she is not, in Buddhism, what she was suffering from was pride. Pride is not mentally very stable. It's when you identify yourself with a certain lifestyle and you believe you are that lifestyle. But anything that is a lifestyle is impermanent. It's based on conditions. Those conditions will change. You will lose it. And your whole sense of comfort and rightness and even sanity will... So that's what had happened to her. Her whole being had toppled because who she identified herself as being, God's in his heaven and all's right with the world, etc., etc., was. So then she began to understand, oh no, my view was too narrow. My acceptance of reality was too limited. I'm sure she didn't put it quite so intellectually. And she went back to the Buddha and she bowed to him and she said, I would like to receive teaching. He said, well, bury your child and we'll get on with it. And so it goes, you know. He taught here, he taught there, with every person, with the circumstance that was available. And all of that teaching is collected in a bunch of books. And it is called the Sutta Pitaka. Sutta means the hearing. Pitaka means baskets. There are three pitaka. One of them is the Sutta Pitaka. Then there is a pitaka that's called the Abhidhamma Pitaka, meaning beyond the usual marketplace pitaka. And that was the pitaka that is considered to be the higher philosophical teaching, the sort of like the nuclear physics of mind. And that was for meditators and for people who had some insight into what is consciousness. And what are those teachings all looking at? They're trying to look at what is reality, what is self, seeing things as they are, with compassionate, non-clinging awareness. The whole aim of Buddha Dharma: to see things as they are with compassionate, non-clinging awareness. Heart and mind. Study and practice. The two. Because we are two-brained. Consciousness is luminous and knowing. Both. So the Sutta Pitaka is basically, the teachings are basically grouped around the five aggregates. They're basically talking about, or working with, the idea of a mind-body conglomerate, wherever it is, an ant, a person, a dog, an angel, can be understood in terms of being composed of five heaps or five aggregates. And indeed, if you look at the Heart Sutra, that's how it starts. Avalokiteshvara, the Mighty Lord. Well, coursing in the deep paths of wisdom gone beyond, looked down and saw five heaps. And that's how the whole thing starts. Five heaps, no inherent self. Moving beyond the boundaries of clinging to a self, Avalokiteshvara looks and sees there are five heaps, five collections. And the five are like a rainbow. They may be there, but you can't separate them. They don't exist individually. They exist as a union, like a hand. One, two, three, four, five. You can't say that my finger exists separately from the whole hand. Is that clear? The five are form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. Mental formations. If you want them in Pali, they are rupa, R-U-P-E-P-A, vedana, V's are W's. V's are sounded like W's, but they're actually V's. V-E, so vedana. You understand? Like Volkswagen. V-E-D-A-N-A. See, I'm trying to slip the bad jokes in, so it's not too bad. Vedana, V-E-D-A-N-A. Sanya, S-A-N-N-A, with S. Both ends are the Spanish end. Little ocean wave over top of each one. Perception. Huh? Oh, the fifth one I haven't got to. How about the fourth one? Should I do the fourth one in Pali first? Or do you want the fifth first? Oh, the fifth one is consciousness in English. And so, rupa, vedana, sanya, sankhara, S-A-N-K-H-A-R-A. Sankhara, and that's called mental formationings. So, of course, you immediately know exactly what that means, don't you? Your mind just goes, oh, yes. Oh, yes, I'm familiar with that. And consciousness is vijnana, V-I-N-N-A-N-A. The first two N's are Spanish N's, okay? Rupa is formation. They're all verbs, by the way. So rupa, or they're all adverbs. They're all movement, so it's formationing. Rupa is that quality of a mind-body conglomerate that creates formation. In its most obvious form, it is the bones, flesh, skin. When you do practicing the four foundations of mindfulness, you start with the body. Four foundations of mindfulness. First, you need to develop a sense of being able to focus. After you focus, you scan, you become aware of the body. In its different postures, you note the body, you pay attention, and you learn three things. It is not self. It is impermanent, and it is subject to dissatisfactoriness. Vedana is feelings. If you're a Buddhist, you have five feelings. Makes it a lot easier, doesn't it? Nice and neat. Did you know that in Pali there are lots and lots of words for consciousness and very few words for feelings? And in English, there's lots and lots of words for feelings and very few words for consciousness. So it makes it interesting trying to understand, you know, from one culture, how another, which window another culture was looking through. You know, and you're in one culture, you're looking out one window, and another culture is looking out another window, and you have to, like, move your mind a little bit and understand that the way you perceive is largely how you were taught to perceive in a community. There are very specific communal rights and realities. And certainly in North America, we are taught to perceive, and undoubtedly in Australia, in the West, we are taught to perceive in terms of a sense of self, as if there were a permanent sense of self. In Buddhism, you're taught that there is rupa, vedana, samya, sankhara, and vijnana. And they are like a river flowing energy. The five feelings are: I like it and I don't like it physical. I like it, I don't like it, and I'm neutral mental. Mental happiness, mental unease, and mental neutrality. Physical like and physical dislike. That's it. Well, that simplifies things a lot, doesn't it? Sanya is perception. There are six doors of perception that you basically work with. When you actually work with them, rather than attaching to the object and thinking that, you know, if you are using your sense doors in the usual kind of way that one does, then everything you see redefines the subject. Because you're looking at things, you see a form, and your mind goes into memory, takes the data of that, goes into memory, creates an object, a collage based on everything you saw in the past, and throws forward a reality you can expect, which then defines who you were up until now, the summation of who you were up until now, meaning the color green. And that is involved in how I am going to react to the color green. Do you understand? It is very, very fast. Very, very, very fast. The only time you're going to see that operating is if you trip when you're running upstairs. When you reach for something that isn't there. When you sit down on a cushion and you just keep sliding. And you watch the mind. The mind goes, because I don't know who I am. Because it is not defining me according to the past. So the mind door is a very powerful perceiving tool. And then the other senses, the data from the other sense doors, is just sort of brought in there to... So from a Buddhist point of view, the sense of self and other is a construct. That's not to say that there is no other and there is no self. It is that what one is generally working with as self and other is habitual based on past actions, and you don't really know who you really are. Because you are habitually creating yourself in every moment based on what you wanted from the past and didn't get, so you're going to try it this way. Or you're going to whop that person until they finally get it right and give you what you want. We have lots of ways of whopping people. Don't we? Oh, what an honest group. Thank you. And the memory of the past does not allow change, right? It is like a photograph album. The photographs have not changed. So there is a sense of stability about the self. There is also a sense of never being different. Every photograph is what it is. So there is this kind of feeling in the felt sense of the selfing quality of consciousness. There is a feeling as if you popped out of the womb exactly as you are now, and when you die, you're just going to continue. You know, there is some quality which from a non-Buddhist point of view, a Buddhist looking at a non-Buddhist point of view would think that those who believe in a permanent self are confusing that felt sense, which is a projection of the mind door, with an actual truth. Because it is not seeing things as they are, that's seeing the mind operating and believing the movie. Believing the movie to be true. And we continuously go to our private movie theaters, don't we? Play our own movies, don't we? We have a few favorite plots, but not too many. It's not really that entertaining, and we are alone in our movie theater, aren't we? Because the memories are individual. The way you were looking out the window, how you felt, what you wanted. The isolation will always continue until you're trying to see the projector. There is a great power in projecting. But you gotta wake up. Once you understand that, you can project what if. Is this really true? What if reality is bigger than my view? Oh, that's enough of that. Back to the movies. Popcorn. And indeed, it is dangerous to ask those questions, so there are systems for asking them. Because you don't get rid of yourself, you understand why selfing is part of consciousness. You know, selfing is part of consciousness. There is not a permanent self. That does not mean there is not self or selfing. There is not a fixed, unchanging, stainless steel ball-bearing self rolling through all time and space. I remember being fascinated when my little brother swallowed a ball bearing and having it come out of his diaper. That was just so fascinating. And it's kind of how we regard ourselves, isn't it? We can say, stay separate from any shit. I got news. In memory, maybe. But don't deny the gifts that are interwoven. So perception is very interesting. There are three stories, you know, like, you call them stories here? Like, of a building? Three levels or three stories? I don't want to, you know, it's nice to learn some Australian cooker. I have to remember cooker, not stove. That's the cooker. That's not Australian. Isn't it? English. That's English? Oh. But my friend in Perth used to say that too. Yeah, it's on the cooker. different perceptions. So there are three main floors or stories through which one perceives reality, inner and outer. And one story has six sense doors, six windows. So you got these six different views coming in, and you put them all together, and it becomes a view of what you think is the inner and outer, how the light comes in, and so on, right? And the sixth one is the one we prefer to dwell in, because we feel so safe with all that data, you know, all coming into one place. You know, it's like a. And the next, and the second story has three sense doors, three windows, three ways of perceiving: sight, sound, and mind. And the top floor is open, has no walls, has no ceiling, has no floor. But there is a knowing state, and it's called mind. Mind only. So we have these three main ways of perceiving, and when you start to meditate, mostly you're going to be on the ground floor working with linear time, figuring out when, you know, a car is going to go past here, or whether you really did lock the door, or gee, should you have phoned such and such to tell them what you were doing today, or I hope I remember to pick up milk on my way home, or, you know? All the busyness of the six doors when you start to meditate. Did you want to ask a question? No. No. It's true in all three. In the Vajrayana, you hear those three floors referred to as utter, inner, and secret. In the Theravada, you hear them referred to as Kamavachara, which is sense desire. Rupavachara, which is material realm, but it implies fine material realm. And arupa vachara, which is non-form, non-material realm. And in English, they're usually referred to as body, speech, and mind. And you see them translated. And there are other ways of discussing these in the Abhidhamma Tipitaka. It is the whole of the higher philosophy of Buddhism is about these three, in which case they are called citta, which means mind, caitasika, which means mind objects, and rupa, which means form. Mind objects are the dancing energies of existence. So there are two ways of perceiving reality, of trying to understand what is a mind-body conglomerate. Because eventually in Buddhism you quit trying to understand what's happening there, because you realize that out there is so colored by the movies you're playing that first you got to see what's happening. And it's the basic law of Buddha Dharma. Never mind whether there is a god or not a god. Never mind whether someone is cruel or uncruel. Never mind whether someone is going to get into trouble or not going to get into trouble. How is it that I am perceiving someone? How is it that I am perceiving an event? Am I actually perceiving things as they are? As a first stage in Buddha Dharma, you come to the point where you want to see who is running the movies. Who is it that's you? So in order to do that, you have to become aware of what is here, what is here-ness, what is this, what is body, what are feelings, what are mind states, what is consciousness. Those become your criteria. Once you know that, then you know the gels, you know, in projection, in theater, they have these colored slides that they put over the spotlights. They're called gels. If you can understand the gels you're looking through, then you might have a better perception of what it is you're seeing and who is looking. When you get into the higher philosophy of Buddhism, you get people arguing about whether there is a total shunya, that there is no object outside of the projector or not, and you get these, you know, hair splitting of mind states that only Buddhism can do. That, you know, for a short burst of period, I just love, because I love playing, you know, I love ping pong. It's one of my favorite, mental ping pong is one of my favorite occupations. But there, you know, like you can get so wound up in trying to understand what is true that you forget to turn the gas off when the kettle's boiled, you know. So there's a point where you really have to just let it go and be willing to practice the Polish mudra. So I'm at what? Feelings, I've done mind state, I'm doing perception now. Okay, so that when you're meditating, you basically start by perceiving with the six sense doors. But every once in a while, you feel like the dimmer switch has changed in the room. You know that? That's when you moved into the second floor a bit. You're moving up and down between the first floor and the second floor. Do you understand what I mean when I say the dimmer switch has changed a bit? The quality of your awareness has sort of softened. There's a more expansive feeling to where you are. Maybe a sense of light changes a bit. You feel more calm. This happens with focus. Because living in this ground floor, you're aware of all the traffic and you're always looking at past, present, future. You're busy conniving and contriving and concepting. Right? You busily try to figure out where you're going, why, who else has been there, and you know, la-di-da-di-da, self-other, relationship. Linear time is very powerful. And then when you stop going somewhere, you let go of the future and actually practice just feeling where you are. You let go of the past and you quit rerunning the same old conversation. And just are present where you are, then there is a different sense of the space you're in. Different sense. It's not, you're not moving into the future, you're not moving into the past. You're not defining the sense of self in linear time. So time becomes more global, it becomes the space you're actually in, which includes the emotional sense of where you are. So it becomes more radiant. In a certain way. So that means you're more on the second floor. When you develop that ability to bring the mind to one point, that's called concentration. Concentration will take you right up to the third floor. It's called jhana, absorption. Jhana. J-H-A-N-A. Jhana is absorption. In jhana states, you can have better highs and better orgasms than anywhere else in the universe, if that's what interests you. Less risky, too. So there are considered to be eight, you know, Buddhism. There are eight jhanas, or nine if you're working from the Abhidhamma system. And the jhanas are defined by states of consciousness are present. For example, you know how when you're looking at me, you can perceive me, but while you're looking at me, keeping your focus on me, you can also see the curtains on the side of the room. You know that? Mm-hmm. So you have both direct, don't look at them, look at me. But you can see the curtains, can't you? Yeah. Oh, yeah, exactly. Lovely. And so also with your mind, you have the mind that goes directly to the point, and you have the mind that does the peripheral data. Do you understand that? The mind that goes directly to the point is the mind that part of your eyes that focuses this object, picking this out, just this. But the peripheral vision gives meaning, shows you how far something is away, what you're going to do with it, what, you know, gives the relationship. And so too in the mind, two mental factors are exactly that. One of them is called vitaka. Let us say if the mind pins on an object. The other is called vichara. That's like aware of the whole spatial quality within which that object exists, right? Is that clear? So in jhana you have, first jhana, you have present, vitaka and vichara, piti, sukha, and ekagata. Those are the states that are present in Pali. So in the second jhana, vitaka disappears, and there is just that peripheral, and no one thing is more picked out, right? The concentration, mind itself is concentrating. There isn't an object. Right? And so jhana goes like that, which mind state is dropped and which one is transformed into what. So form jhanas, there are four or five, depending on whether you're looking in the Abhidhamma or the Sutta Pitaka, and then the formless jhanas, which are boundless space, boundless consciousness, neither perception nor non-perception, and no thingness. The four boundless states. And these are all ways of moving up and down those three stories of the perceptive base, how perception works. So it is entirely possible when you're moving between the first floor and the second floor to have extraordinary meditational experiences, you know, where Michael and Raphael and, you know, Gabriel, all the L's, you know, A-L means of God, E-L is God, Michael is actually Mich-A-L, Raphael, Gabriel. So all the A-L's come around and tell you that, yes, it's true, you really are the Beloved. And lift you up, and you're glorified, and, you know, like, la-di-da-di-da. And that's all very well and good, but it's still just moving between the perceptive levels. And it is still a kind, you know, there can be insights and experiences, mystical experiences, heavens and hells, that are very interesting. Yeah, thank you very much. How marvelous. And is it true on the rising breath, or is it true on the falling breath? That's what you do with it. Because those perceptions are also not self, impermanent, and subject to dissatisfactoriness. Some of them can last lifetimes. And then when they're not there, you're subject to that same mental instability as occurs with pride. You get angry, disoriented, you don't know who you are when they are not present. So So then house states can manifest. Is that clear? So whenever great blessings, great mystical experiences, great la-di-das happen in meditation, accept them, open your heart to them, and keep your focus. Don't get sidetracked. Don't get sidetracked. Wonderful, glorious, joyous. Yes, that's right. This is really great. Bliss states are really great because they break down your pity, your pitiful little view of who you are. As large as totality and as small as a mustard seed, you know, that's who you are. There is no experience that if you have decided to maintain yourself in a human form, there is no experience that you cannot transmute. It's a symbol of compassion. Do you know why? And they eat seeds which would be poisonous to other birds. Yeah. And what happens? And their colors become brighter from the poison. You got that? You can eat seeds which would be poisonous to other birds, and what happens is your colors get brighter. That's why a peacock represents compassion. It's not because you're distant and you look at them suffering and practice largesse. I don't think so. Because you don't believe the story. You allow yourself to totally feel the energy, but you're not attached to the movie. There is space. For another possibility. Is this interesting? How you doing? You like this classic Buddhist stuff? I love it. It's my favorite. So I'm indulging myself. You don't mind. So where am I? Finished perception now? Did that give you some ideas about perception? Now, mental formations. I was in the Dead Sea with a bunch of friends hanging out, trying to sink.
How?
Trying not to open my eyes underwater. Also, I might add, do you know about the Dead Sea? What do you know about it? Why is it salty? You can't sink. It's super saturated. Why is it salty? Because it was at one time part of a whole sea, salty water, saturated salts in it, and then it got cut off, right? The water level dropped, right? And it's in a very hot place, right? So what did it do? Evaporated. Do the salts evaporate? No way. So there's less and less water to hold them in solution, and it becomes denser and denser and denser. It must be the one that, oh, don't say that. So you're too close. Oh dear. Okay, so when you're in the Dead Sea and you're standing there, and the light is intense, and if the light isn't just straight down, but it's coming at an angle, you can see into the water, and you can see crystals almost forming, because it's so saturated with salts and minerals. And then a wave comes, and it just breaks them apart. But there is a propensity for all those chemicals to form. Do you understand that? That's what mental formations are like. This propensity that if the conditions are right, this will suddenly arise. Propensity, all conditions here, that will arise. Propensity. So it's hard to describe other than saying they are mental formationings. And given the combination with the other five aggregates and set in motion, they do crystallize into just this or just that quality of mind, or a little hatred here, or a little joy there, and then dissolve back into the mind stuff. A little pattern here, a little pattern there. This arises, this propensity arises, this arises, this propensity arises. And they are fluid like that. And what is it that causes this one to continuously occur in this circumstance when you see this way with this sense of form? You getting the idea? You can't separate the five. But you can see the conscious mind-body conglomerate operating with five different qualities. The five dakinis are dancing. So there are 52 of them. Ah, Buddhism. And I'm not going to go through them. And they become, in the Four Foundations of Mindfulness, the awareness of mind states. Chittasikas, they're called. The 52 Chittasikas. In the Tibetan tradition, you got Vajrayogini dancing and dancing and dancing, right? And she's got this necklace of 50 severed heads. It usually says in the sadhana, but if you get more complete teaching, it's actually 51. Because it is the 51 of the Chaitasikas that she has cut off from their blindness. But the 52nd is like a pig's head coming out of her head. Desire. Seductive desire. Desire without object, without subject. In a lot of ways, in one of her softer moods, Vajrayogini is like that saying in the Quran, above every blade of grass is an angel whispering, grow, grow, grow. Very seductive. So that's mental formations, mental formationings. And the last one is consciousness, vijnana. This is the type of consciousness that names. This is the name giver consciousness. This is not citta, which is another name for consciousness. This is not mana, which is another name of consciousness. There are many, many words for consciousness, but this is the type of consciousness that picks out, identifies, gives name, understands patterns, perceives in a naming kind of way, which can become, if there is an understanding of the impermanence of naming and the beautiful energy of naming, can become what they call paññāti, which is discriminating. The mind, the totality mind of discriminating wisdom. Vijnana can become the great power of discriminating wisdom. So you have these five aggregates. And they are like wavelengths, vibrations, you know, going from just exactly in a way like a rainbow, which is why they called rainbow consciousness when you perceive them as a subjective experience. They are the rainbow of being. So they're vibrating at different frequencies. So form is like vibrating the slowest in a way. So it's the most solid in a way. Consciousness is vibrating the fastest. They say in Buddhism, they say that consciousness or mind beats 17 times faster than matter. And matter beats at the speed of light. So that what I wonder is how they measured it. That's what. But that's what they say.
You used to do lots of quick things. Cut up banana leaves with swords. Really sharp swords.
You did or they did?
I have done.
You did, yeah.
Buddha said, everything goes on and off 7 trillion times in nanosecond. But how, that's what physicists say today. And what they used to say, the time it takes the sword in the master swordsman to go through the 57th leaf of a stack of 81. Gets it like its terminal velocity is a stroke from the master. The time it takes the blade to pass through that leaf was the anu, the smallest time span that they were interested in measurement and that you can talk about.
Mm-hmm.
So they related it to actual things they did.
Mm-hmm.
And I guess a nanosecond's about the equivalent of what time it would take for the blade to pass through a leaf at that speed. So, you know, they did have concepts of very, very
small. Oh, there's no question.
Most people, apart from physics, metaphysical physics, mathematical concepts, they don't have. Now we're away from all of that sort of things.
No question. And meditating, by moving the consciousness to infinity and to a point again is very a powerful tool for developing a different perception of time and space. There's no question.
Make yourself big.
Mm-hmm.
Make yourself small. Can you see the subatomic particles?
In the first 10 of the classical meditations in Buddhism, the 40 classical meditations, there's a text called the Visuddhimagga. Do you know that book? Yeah, and the first 10 are basically the first 4, earth, water, fire, air. And one of the things that you do is once you can do what they call the inner casino, you can totally reproduce the outer casino with your mind without any problem. Then you have several different exercises that you do, and one of them is expanding them and contracting it. It's very interesting work. That's very interesting work.
It's unimaginable how fine an instrument
you're pushing it a little bit. I'm not sure I'll go that far.
I'm sorry, it is.
I'm not sure I'll go unimaginable. You're pushing it now. Well, that's what you have to know. You have to know what it is that is looking. I mean, it cannot trust what you're seeing unless you also have some, at least the roughest concept of what it is that is looking. Not if you're really interested. You know, if you're more interested in your view than you are in who is viewing, then sure, go ahead, you know. Chase that carrot that's on that string that's linked to that stick that's tied to your head. And if you want to know what it is that perceives it and what the desire is that causes you to run and all that stuff, then you're probably going to, you know, learn how to take another stick and get the carrot. Or you have that option then. So there's value in these understandings, there's no question. So every mind-body conglomerate is made of these five aggregates: form, feeling, perception, mental formations, and consciousness. What makes a difference between a dog and a human is, say, how the proportion of perception to form, or the perception of feeling to consciousness. Do you understand? How wide the band is of each color in a certain way. What makes a difference between a human's that is happy and joyous and giving and fine, and a human that isn't, is the color, the clarity of the color of it, you know, whether the red is a bit muddy or... Do you understand that? Interesting thing to know is you have every ability to clear up the colors. If you're willing. And a human balance of the five aggregates is considered to be the most auspicious balance in order to be able to see things as they are with compassionate, non-clinging awareness. Considered to be the best point of view. Easiest access to the three doors, to the three floors. Beings who live on the top floor tend to not go to the second floor or the first floor. Beings on the bottom floor tend to bite each other too much so that they never realize there's a stairway. Do you understand that? I'm using very crude analogies, but maybe they give you a felt sense of how the consciousness will operate. So when you're sitting there in your mind and you're meditating and you find yourself arguing with yourself or wondering whether you should do something other, just consider yourself barking and snarling on the first floor. You know, just consider yourself doing that and just relax a little bit and see if you can feel your body all around. Be aware of yourself sitting here. Change your perception. You're too narrowed in on me and what I should be doing. You know? Too narrowed in. Allow yourself a little more space. Be present. And then then go back to your meditation object and try to feel it from a different perspective. For example, if you're watching the breath here, when you begin, you pay attention to where you're feeling it. Then after a while, pretty soon, the self begins arguing with projections, or, you know, doing little mini movies, little commercials. Starts running little commercials, you know, and then I'm going to buy this, and then I'm going to buy that. This is the best brand, and that's the best, you know. Doesn't it?
Yeah.
So then you start watching the commercials with real, and by pretending you're still watching the brand. You catch yourself doing that. You can say thinking, which is the traditional way of doing it. This is thinking. Or if there's a pain in your left leg, you can say feeling. But then what next thing you do is see if you can change your window, change your point of view. Try to feel from the inside of the surface of your skin around your nostril where the breath is passing. Change your stance. At the window. Change the self. Don't just go back up to the turret and try to send, you know, the periscope down to see. Use your sense doors. Believe you have rights. Understand that if you just change your habitual way of perception, already you've dropped the habitual sense of self. And that's like 2/3 of the battle right there. So you want to get up and walk around a bit and jump up and down and all that. And then in about like 10 minutes time, we'll do a little bit of sitting. Is that a good idea? Okay. And when you test of it, and it should take you about 7 years, you know? Did you know that? You respect them for their commitment, for their association, for the robes, for their vows, for whatever, and for at least, you know, a while, you test to see whether you and they work well together. And that doesn't mean they make you happy all the time. Doesn't even mean you understand them. One of the things you look for is, do the seeds of karma ripen quickly when you're around them or when you're working with their direction? That's one of the most important things. Would you like to do it over, like, Just watch your breath. Is an itch, when there is a pain, don't react your usual way. Just notice it and try to see what Thank you for your great compassion.